I have a question for everyone today. You are young. You can still do great things. What do you hope to be, or what do you hope to do that will bring the greatest good to this world? What do you hope to be, or what do you hope to do that will make the greatest contribution to this world? Well, maybe you say to yourself, well, Pastor, I'm not so young anymore. You know, I was young once, and I was once very ambitious. I had great hope and I had great dreams, but those young, ambitious days are behind me. Now you can only put your hope and your dream on your children or grandchildren. Well, what do you hope your children or grandchildren to be or do that will bring the greatest good and make the greatest contribution to the world? It's not too big a question. It's not too big a dream. It's not too big an ambition or too big a hope. Everyone, you and me, young or old, we need to ask ourselves the same question. To the very end of our days on earth, we can still do the greatest good. We can still make the greatest contribution. But what is it? The greatest good, the greatest contribution that we can do is to make peace. The greatest thing that we can be is to be peacemakers. Jesus himself said in his first recorded sermon, Jesus, blessed are the peacemakers. Why? For they shall be called sons of God. Sure, I mean, be doctors that heal. The world cannot have enough doctors, especially in places that are desperately poor and underserved. But every patient, a physician heals, will die sooner or later. So the success rate of every physician is still zero. The world needs more billionaires. And not just any billionaires, but billionaires like Bill Gates or Buffett, who gave enormous sum of money to charity. I was told that the charity work of Bill Gates actually decreased infant. One person was able to decrease the infant mortality of the world. I admire people like Bill Gates. I admire people like Warren Buffett. They had the ability to accumulate enormous sum of wealth. And also they had the moral strength to give their wealth away for the good of men. They were able to increase the survivability of infants. They were able to lengthen the lifespan of men. But what kind of a world are these great philanthropists bringing people into? A world of conflicts. Because of Bill Gates' gift, more and more children are able to go to school. But when they go to school, will they find safety? Will they find security in schools? You know, we think of school shooting as only recent development of a violent society. When we think of school shooting, we can only think of Columbine High School in Colorado, or Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, or Virginia Tech. But in reality, the first recorded school shooting took place in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, July 26, 1764. That is 12 years before our country was even founded. The next recorded school shooting took place in 1853 in Louisville, Kentucky. A young man by the name of Matthew Ward came to school with a gun and shot the schoolmaster dead. The reason? Why? Revenge. Because Mr. Butler, the schoolmaster, had punished Matthew Ward's brother the previous day. And Matthew Ward thought that the punishment was too excessive. I have counted 310 school shootings since the founding of this country. And this country is only 237 years old. That is more than one school shooting for every year since this country has been founded. I didn't even count how many people were killed because of school shooting. We bring our children into a world of bitter conflicts. So we say, okay, we will keep our children from school. We will keep them home for their safety. But how safe is our home? How safe is our home from conflicts? In past decades, it was commonly estimated that half of every marriage in the United States eventually end up in divorce. Nowadays, we modify the number. Today, we estimate to be between 40% to 50%. We say, wow, we are doing better. Finally, we have some statistics that we can celebrate. We think the divorce rate is coming down. But really? One of the biggest reasons why divorce rate is dropping is because Americans are no longer getting married. We don't even bother to go through the formality of marriage. We just decide to live together as partners. And when conflict comes, we just go separate ways. No divorce recorded, because there never was a marriage. That gives us a false impression that we are doing better in our home, in our marriage. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the report announced 3-4 years ago in 2009, there were 13.7 million single-parent households in the United States, and there are 21.8 million children who are being brought in single-parent home. Where is the parent? Why are they home raising their children? Please, don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to beat up those of us who are divorced. I'm not doing that. And don't go out around saying pastor is mean on those that are divorced. I'm not trying to condemn those of us who live in conflicts with their spouse. Those of us who are divorced are treasured and loved in this church. Children who are growing up in a single family homes are treasured and loved by us. We all have conflicts with our spouses, great or small, frequently or rarely. We all fight. We all have conflicts. I am just saying, our children are being born into a world of conflicts, and our world is desperately in need of peacemakers. I can go on and on with unending stories, unending statistics that show we live in a world of conflicts, and there is a desperate need for peacemakers, for those of us, for us to make peace. And God's message for this morning is this: we are called to be peacemakers. Peace. Turn with me back to the passage that we read earlier, verses 22 to verse 34 in chapter 21. This passage will tell us that peace must be built on four pillars. Peace must be built on the pillar of humility, honesty, reciprocity, and justice. This passage tells us that Abimelech and Abraham made peace together. And they made their peace based on humility, honesty, reciprocity, and justice. Let's look at the first one. Peace must be built on humility. Now, first of all, humility is not appeasement. We parents fail in our parenting because we are just like Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain was at one time Prime Minister of England, British. We seek to appease. A child is throwing a tantrum. He wants candy at a grocery store checkout. He won't quit. He's screaming, he's kicking, he's embarrassing you until you get him what he wants. So what do? This is Parenting 101. What do? You want him to quiet down. You want him to stop embarrassing you. You want to make peace with him. So you appease him by giving him what he wants. Now he has a candy in his hand and his mouth. You think he's going to appease? Sure he is. He's got his mouth full of candies. He will be peaceful until he finishes his candy. Appeasement is not humility. Appeasement never makes peace. Appeasement only encourages more aggression. Now the child knows that he can manipulate you, and he will be even more aggressive the next time. Hitler came to power in Germany in 1933, and right away he began a secret rearmament of Germany. And in 2 years, by 1935, he didn't even bother to be secretive about it. He openly flaunted his rearmament. And that is a blatant violation of the Versailles Treaty. And the British and the French said nothing, because they had suffered enormous loss in World War I. They could not afford another war. They want peace. They don't want conflict. So they said nothing and they did nothing. Hitler now knew that Great Britain and France would say nothing and do nothing, so Hitler became even more aggressive. March 7, 1936, Hitler began reoccupation of the Rhineland. That is a part between, there's a western part of Germany between France and Germany. It's supposed to be a militarized zone, and no German army is supposed to station there. Germany, Hitler, reoccupying the Rhineland. Again, Great Britain and France said nothing and did nothing. That was appeasement. They wanted peace. They do not want conflict. And so Hitler got even more aggressive. March 12, 1938, Hitler annexed Austria. Again, there was a blatant violation of the Versailles Treaty. Again, Britain and France did nothing and said nothing. Because they wanted war, they don't want conflicts. That was appeasement. So Hitler got even more aggressive. He started demanding annexation, a part of Czechoslovakia called Sudetenland. Great Britain and France wanted to make peace and not conflict. So the Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, flew to Munich and had a meeting with Hitler. And on September 30, 1938, they signed a Munich Pact. They got the piece of paper with the signatures on it. Chamberlain flew back to London, and we got off the plane. He had a press conference. He took the paper out of his pocket, and he waved around, and he said, "Now we have peace for our time." Great Britain and France wanted peace and not war. What was the Munich Agreement? The Munich Agreement was that Great Britain and France agreed to let Hitler take over Sudetenland. They won't say anything. But they say, "Hitler, Mr. Hitler, no more after this. No more demand." And Hitler said, "Okay." 5 months later, March 15, 1939, Hitler began invasion and the occupation of the entire Czechoslovakia. Again, Great Britain and France did nothing and said nothing because they wanted peace. They do not want conflict. That was appeasement. Now Hitler began demanding for Poland. What's the point? And by the way, it was exactly 74 years ago today that Hitler invaded Poland. What was the point? The point is that peace must be built on humility, and humility is never appeasement. Humility is strength. Humility is not yielding to demand, hoping that the aggressor will be happy. Humility is not passively sitting around doing nothing and saying nothing, but actively and firmly saying and doing what is good and what is right. Humility is not an expression of weakness, but expression of strength. Strength to deny demands and strength to take the initiative to do what is right, to take the first step toward the right direction. It takes a lot more strength to take the first step to do and say the right thing. That is exactly what Abimelech demonstrated for us in this passage. He was a peacemaker, and it was Abimelech who took the first step toward Abraham and make peace. Verse 22. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his forces, said to Abraham, "God is with you in everything you do. Now swear to me before God that," so on and so forth. It was Abimelech. It was he who took his Secretary of Defense, his highest ranking general, to see Abraham. It was Abimelech who extended his hands of peace. And now we have to remember, Abimelech actually outranked Abraham. Abimelech was the king of Gerar. Abraham was just a chief of a large group of nomadic people. He couldn't even call himself the chief of a large tribe, because the only son Abraham at that time with him was Isaac, and he was only about 3 or 4 years old, just learning to walk and run. Abraham had a teenage son who could stand up and fight, but he wasn't around anymore because Ishmael had been kicked out of the household together with his mother. Sure, Abraham was fabulously rich, but so was Abimelech. There's no reason for Abimelech to think that he was inferior to Abraham. And yet, why would he take the first step toward Abraham? Why would he extend his hand of peace? It was his humility. And his humility were not necessarily directed toward Abraham. Abimelech was actually acknowledging his humility toward Abraham's God. Verse 22, God is with you in everything you do. He's saying to Abraham, not because you are so moral, Abraham, you are not. Not because you are so deserving, Abraham, you are not. Scum that you are, Abraham. You have wronged me so deeply. Nevertheless, for the sake of your God, I will humble myself. I will come to you, and I will extend my hand of peace to you. We need to do the same, don't we? We need to extend our hands and make peace with someone, whoever he may be. Not because he was so good, not because he was so deserving, but because for God's sake, we who are peacemakers, we will be the one who takes the first step. Think about the strained relationship that you have with someone. Think about the person that you need and I need to make peace with. We will be the one who takes the first step. It takes enormous strength to be humble. It takes enormous strength to deny demands. It takes enormous strength to arrest aggression. And it takes even more strength to take the first step, to do what is right, to go to the right direction. And that is the first pillar on which peace must be built. The second pillar is honesty. Peace must be built on honesty. 1 week before Hitler invaded Poland, it was August 23, 1939, Hitler signed a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Hitler and Stalin promised each other that they would not invade each other. They also agreed to partition Poland and the Baltic states. So for a while, there was peace between Germany and the Soviet Union. But really, was that peace built on honesty? Less than 2 years later, on June 22, 1941. Now, everybody remembers December 7, 1941, right? But hardly anybody will remember what happened on June 22, 1941. June 22, 1941, Hitler invaded Soviet Union. And in the next 4 years before the war is over, 20 million Russians will die. All because that the peace that they made in 1939 was built on a lie. September 18, 1931, Japanese occupied Manchuria. Every Chinese should remember that date. At that time, the United States said nothing and did nothing, because we were in no position to do anything or say anything because we were deep in the middle of the Depression. July 7, 1937, every Chinese should remember that date. The Japanese began an all-out invasion of China. And now in 1937, the United States was able to say something. The United States demanded Japanese to withdraw from China. But the United States was in no condition to intervene militarily. So the United States used economic sanctions and embargo. First embargo was against aircraft and aircraft parts to be exported to Japan. And then it becomes aviation fuel. And then later on, including the oil and scrap metal. And finally, Roosevelt just froze all Japanese assets in the United States. Now, what did the Japanese do in response? The Japanese got even more aggressive. The Japanese began invasion and occupation of Indochina and Dutch Indies, today's Indonesia. Now we are in 1941. The Japanese government sent a special envoy and an ambassador to negotiate peaceful settlement with the United States. Now, was that peace negotiation built on honesty? Now, everybody remember December 7, 1941. It was 2:40 in the afternoon in Washington. The Japanese special envoy and Japanese ambassador were sitting in the office of Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State. December 7th, 2:40 in the afternoon. What time was that in Hawaii? 2:40 in the afternoon, December 7th, these two Japanese were talking with Cordell Hull about how finally we can settle. They were delivering the final reply from the Japanese government to the American Secretary of State. And they concluded that they could not go on. And their final word is, the immutable policy of Japan is to promote world peace. And when they were saying those words, at the very moment, Japanese bombs have been raining down on Pearl Harbor for over 40 minutes. That was peace built on lies. We can never make any peace with lies. 4 years of bloody struggle in Europe and in the Pacific cost Americans 1 million lives. Peace can never be built on lies. That is what we see in Abimelech's peacemaking. Look with me in verse 23. Abimelech said, "Now swear to me here before God that you will not deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants." You see, Abraham had no credibility whatsoever. He had been lying again and again to save his own skin. And the term for peace is that he should not break any more trust from now on. Now, how does that apply to us? How do we build peace based on honesty? Do you know what the opposite of honesty? Honesty is not necessarily lies. The opposite of honesty is not necessarily lie. The opposite of honesty is denial. When we are confronted with wrong, right away we become so defensive and right away we deny. Now, just an example, I'm going to use myself as an example. Just say that I abuse my wife. Just say that I abuse my wife verbally and emotionally and physically. And it's so bad that everybody in church, everybody in Chicago knows about it. And everyone except me. But you care for me. You care for the welfare of the church. So the church sent a delegation to come to me and confront me. Now, what do you think the first thing I'm going to do? The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to be defensive and I'm going to deny it. That's not honesty. That is denial. I will say, I'm not abusive. I'm a very nice guy. I'm going to say I'm a gentle fellow. I'm a very nice and cool kind of a guy. I am not capable of abusing my wife. Now, that is so contrary to fact that everybody knows. But why would I deny it? There are actually two reasons why I deny it. I may deny it because I may deny it knowingly, or I may deny it unknowingly. I may deny knowing full well that I'm abusive. Now, that would make me a liar, wouldn't it? I'm trying to protect myself. But yet, there's another probability. I may deny my abusive behavior because I just simply don't know it. Because my mind, because my perception, because my understanding, because my judgment might have been so distorted, might have been so twisted, might have been so clouded, might have been taken captive by Satan's hand and work, that I genuinely am not able to grasp the reality that I am abusive. So I deny it, not because I'm a liar, but because I don't have the mental capacity to grasp reality. But in either case, I'm not being honest with myself and I'm not being honest with the situation. As long as I deny the reality that I'm an abuser, there will be no peace between my wife and me. Only by God's grace and by God's power, only when my mind, only when my heart have to be brought to a point where I accept the reality that I'm an abuser. And I have to be brought to a point that I can be honest with myself, that I have to be honest with the situation, then and only then can peace begun to rebuild. Because peace has to be built on honesty and not on denial. Of course, don't go around spreading rumors that Pastor Tam abuses his wife. I'm just only using that as an example, because the heart of conflicts, the root of so many conflicts, whether it's at home or at church, is that people are not able to be honest with himself and awe with the situation. Unless honesty is restored, unless denial is removed, there can be no peace. The third pillar is reciprocity. Reciprocity means equal exchange of terms. Reciprocity does not mean moral compromise. It means equal exchange of terms. Now, we Chinese should know this term, unequal treaty. Treaty of Nanjing in 1842. Treaty of Tianjin in 1858. Treaty of Shimonoseki, 1895. The Boxer Protocol, 1901. The 21 Demand in 1915. Just to name a few, those are all called unequal treaties. Why unequal? Because they were forced on the Chinese under the gun by foreign powers. And all the terms were lopsided. It's always millions and millions and millions of indemnity paid by the weak to the powerful. Always territorial concessions, always political concessions yielded by the weak to the strong. Always under the gun, always under duress, always under violent pressure. Treaty that are unequal never bring peace. The Treaty of Versailles was one example. It was signed by Germany under the guns of the French and the British. And that is why the Treaty of Versailles never brought peace. Instead, the Treaty of Versailles brought World War II. The peace that Abimelech made with Abraham teaches us that peace must be built on reciprocity. In other words, it was built on equal terms. Look at verse 20. The last half of verse 23. Abimelech says, show to me and the country where you are living as an alien the same kindness I have shown to you. Abimelech is asking for reciprocity, equal terms. I have been so good to you, Abraham. I have been so generous to you, Abraham. Now you show my children, now you show my descendants the same kindness, the same generosity, the same goodness. You know why are there so many conflicts in marriage? Why are there so many conflicts in the home, in the church, or anywhere? It's because everyone wants their own terms met. And everyone wants to disregard the terms of the others. Everyone wants his own interests met and disregard the interests of the other. That is not reciprocity. That is self-centeredness. That is selfishness. And peace can never be built on self-centeredness. Parents, if you want your children to respect you, earn that respect. Children respect you, you earn that. That's reciprocity. If you want peace with your children, love and respect their mother. That's reciprocity. Men, if you want your wife to be submissive to you, earn their trust by honoring them, by seeking their interests. That's reciprocity. Dear people, if you want someone's friendship, set aside your terms and respect the others. That's reciprocity. Unless there is reciprocity, there's no peace. The fourth pillar is justice. Years ago, I used to drive on the street and I saw a bumper sticker behind a car. And I see so much truth in that. The bumper sticker said, if you want peace, work for justice. That is so true. When there is justice, there is peace. Wherever there is justice, there is peace. As long as one party felt that he has suffered injustice, there won't be peace. And we see that in this episode, Abraham is about to consummate, about to sign the dotted line. He's about to complete this peace treaty. Abimelech has shown humility. Abraham recognized that. He came first to him. Abraham recognized that. Abimelech asked for honesty. Abraham said, I agree. Abimelech had asked for reciprocity. Abraham said, I agree. But something is holding up this peace treaty. Why couldn't they make this peace treaty right there and then? Abraham could not because there was one little problem. And that is in verse 25 to 26. Abimelech Abraham. Abraham complained to Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servant has seized. But Abimelech said, I don't know who has done this. You did not tell me, and I heard about it only today. Abraham, in his heart and his mind, that's gross injustice. And unless and until this grievance is addressed, there can be no peace. Abraham needed Abimelech to acknowledge that Abraham was the one who had dug this well, and therefore the well and the water right belonged to him, and that Abimelech's men had seized the well unjustly, denying Abraham access to water for his livestock. And that gross injustice must be addressed, and Abimelech must accept culpability on behalf of his men and restore the well to Abraham. In order to do that, Abraham did something that Abimelech could not understand. In addition to the sheep and cattle that Abraham provided to conclude the peace treaty, remember those animals are to be cut up, put on the ground, and the two parties will walk through the cut up pieces. That's to symbolize that should anyone break this treaty, may the offending party be cut up and die just like these animals. But in addition to the animals that were cut up, Abraham set aside 7 ewe lambs. They were not touched. They were not cut up. Abimelech was puzzled as to what those meaning of those 7 ewe lambs. And Abraham explained to them, they are gifts of acknowledgement. I'm going to give them to you as gifts. And when you accept them, that means you're acknowledging that it is I who had dug the well. Therefore, the well and the water right belongs to me. That means you acknowledge injustice has been done me by your men. That means you acknowledge I am in the right and your men are in the wrong. And Abimelech accepted those ewe lambs, because in verse 31 it says, so the peace was called, that place was called Beersheba, because the two men swore an oath there. Beersheba literally means well of 7. There were 7 lambs, or a well of oath. That bumper sticker was absolutely right. If you want peace, work for justice. That is why it's so difficult to make peace, because it is so difficult to work for justice. 2 persons are in bitter conflict, and you are a peacemaker, and you want to make peace. Are you sure that you are making the right judgment as to who is the offending party and who is the offended? Are you sure that you are making the right judgment, that you know who is a wrongdoer and who is suffering unjustly? I really admire Abimelech, not only because he was a man of humility, not only because he asked for the right terms, honesty and reciprocity. He had the discernment to judge correctly. After all, Abraham was not a man known for his integrity. He had lied multiple times, and what makes Abimelech think that he won't lie again about the well? Abimelech has reason to think that Abraham is lying about the well. I'm sure his men who seized the well would be very vocal, denying the wrongdoing. Now, why would Abimelech believe Abraham and not his own men? We don't know the answer why, but Abimelech were able to make the final right judgment. The point is not how he made the right judgment. The point is that he made a correct judgment and allowed peace to be made. I don't know how Abimelech got his discernment, but the fact that he made a correct judgment allowed peace to be made. And for those of us who want to be peacemakers, find out all the facts in any conflict first. Find out the whole truth first. There can be no peace as long as one of the parties felt injustice is being done him. And that is why I keep saying we fail in our parenting. Because when 2 brothers fight, when 2 sisters fight, we jump to conclusion right away, you are wrong and you are right. And the one who felt that he suffered injustice would say it is not fair. There can be no peace as long as one of the parties felt injustice is done him. So to us who will be peacemakers, seek the truth, work for justice, right the wrong, before we can even begin to make peace. Humility, honesty, reciprocity, and justice. Any peace built on foundation other than these 4 pillars will never be real peace that will last. And when peace is made, when real peace is made, it brings great blessing. Here, the peace treaty has been made in Beersheba. Abimelech and his commander returned to Gerar satisfied. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree as a memorial, and he began again. He started worshiping God in thanksgiving. And Abraham stayed in the land of Philistine peacefully for a very long time. And this peace lasted a very long time. Whenever there is peace, there is blessing. And my greatest hope and my prayer for our church is that we are a congregation of peace. Not peace at all costs. Not peace that is bought by appeasement, but peace that is built on humility of one another, peace that is built on honesty with oneself and with one another, peace that is built on reciprocity, not anyone demanding that others should meet his terms, but God's demands met on God's terms. Peace for our church that is built on justice. I hope and pray that we share what is dear to me. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Jesus did not mean that we can earn our way to heaven by making peace. When we make peace, we are sons of God because we are so much like God. For God is peace and God delights in peace. 50 years ago, there was a peacemaker in this country. And he taught and he led many to make peace. And today we enjoy so much blessing. It's because of the peace that that person and those who follow him made for us. It's exactly 50 years ago that this man by the name of Martin Luther King, he wrote a pledge. He called it a pledge card, a commitment card. And it required all those who seek peace with him. He required all those who join him in making peace should sign this commitment card. And he called it the Ten Commandments. And these Ten Commandments that they pledge to follow reflects wonderfully these four pillars: honesty, humility, reciprocity, and justice. He said, "Those, if you want to follow me in this civil rights movement, sign this paper." It says, "Meditate daily on the teaching and life of Jesus." That's the first one. He said, "Remember always that the nonviolent movement seek justice and reconciliation and not victory." He said, "Walk and talk in the manner of love, for God is love." He said, "Pray daily to be used by God in order that all men might be free." He used the word free. If I may change that, pray daily to be used by God in order that all men might be at peace. He said, "Sacrifice personal wishes in order that all men might be free." Allow me to change that a little bit. Sacrifice personal wishes in order that all men might be at peace. Observe with both foes and friends the ordinary rules of courtesy. He said, "Seek to perform regular service for others and for the world." He said, "Refrain from violence of fist, tongue, or heart." He said, "Strive to be in good spiritual and bodily health." And finally, he said, "Follow the direction of the movement and of the captains in demonstration." Those are goals that he made for himself, and those are goals that he made for others who seek to make peace. Humility, honesty, reciprocity, and justice. And he brought a great deal of peace in our nation. And we enjoy so much blessing today because of the peace that they brought. Peace can be built, peace has been built, and peace needs to be built even more. And that is why God called us to be peacemakers. So that this place, our home, our church, maybe even more peaceful than ever before. Let's all stand together. God has called us to be peacemakers. God has called us to